The following was written by Brian Davey and originally published on Fiesta, cross-posted on Resilience on April 6th, 2018, which is my beloved wife Connie Barlow's 66th birthday. Indigenous Economics. Editor's note, this is chapter 16 from Brian's book Credo. The book has its own website, which can be found here in the top. Mainstream economics regards environmental protection as a matter of finding the right price for environmental preferences. This is not how indigenous people think about environmental issues. The chapter contrasts the mentalities of people that belong to places versus the mindset of the population when places belong to people. Say that again. This chapter contrasts the mentalities of people that belong to place versus the mindset of the population when place belongs to people. There are differing epistemes in different societies, and traditional environmental knowledge, quote-unquote, is a totally different way of knowing to that taken for granted by economists. This section of the book is devoted to several chapters on a set of themes almost entirely neglected by contemporary economists: land. For decades, economists have been uninterested in the topic. Their heads are in the clouds, spinning theories about the worlds of high finance, without their feet being on the ground. Yet a very large part of the financial securities that the economists theorize are ultimately based on income streams that derive from land and locations. The financial economy must derive its income from real sources. Financial assets are titles to income streams, but where does this income come from? To a very large extent, the answer is from mortgages, loans to property companies, and capitalized rental streams, payments for places. Economist Michael Hudson has a name for the dominant part of the modern economy, the FIRE, F-I-R-E sector. FIRE stands for finance, insurance, and real estate. They are very closely integrated, which will be explored later in this book. The point here is simply to indicate that if land appears to have disappeared from economics, it's because finance is obscuring the view. Say it again. The point here is that if land has appeared to disappear from economics, to have disappeared, it's because finance is obscuring the view. This is a critical situation because the most serious problem facing humanity is the damaging relationship between the economic system and the ecological system. Say it again. The most serious problem facing humanity is the damaging relationship between the economic system and the ecological system. As regards this most serious crisis, mainstream economists have no explanatory framework worthy of intellectual respect. Finding the quote-unquote right price for the environmental preferences. If we follow standard economic approaches to the environment, then the appropriate way to protect it is to elicit the strength of people's preferences for nature, or its different attributes. This is done by finding out how much people are prepared to pay to maintain it. In other words, how much money they are prepared to accept in compensation for its destruction for economic purposes. It's all a matter of finding the right price, see chapter 26. However, this implies that people have already formed preferences, and that, in turn, implies that they actually know about the environment or aspects of the environment that are being threatened. In practice, most people have limited experience in assigning monetary value to environmental goods because this requirement does not occur in everyday life. One may also question whether people have preferences for all environmental goods. For example, can we have preferences for a species threatened by extinction if we never knew it existed? If we have preferences for the species, they must have been created rather quickly and are likely to be far from stable over time. Therefore, it's important to take the process of preference formation seriously. That was from a 2002 book, Johnson Stedman. In this chapter, it's my intention to explore what ought to be blindingly obvious. That is, that the everyday life of many people precludes them getting much information about ecological systems and nature, or forming deep preferences, quote-unquote, that would result in their having the will to protect it. For billions of people, nature and the ecosystem have become out of sight, out of mind. The evolution of market society has progressively cut off whole populations from the possibility of knowledge about the environment. In fact, society has evolved institutions and practices that actively try to prevent them being adequately informed about the perilous state of the ecological system. actively try to mislead them about how dangerous things are, and actively encourage participation in a system of consumption that uses resources without considering ecological consequences. This is a system intent on shaping people's values in an anti-ecological way. Okay, I'm not going to reread that paragraph, but it's a great paragraph. You might want to go back and listen. While the economists tell us that what makes a market society so wonderful is that it caters to people's preferences, allocating resources according to the signals in market valuations, the deeper reality is that the most powerful players in the economy seek to shape what we value, what value we place on things like ecological system reality. They do so in their own interests and in ways that foster ignorance or indifference to ecological destruction. To consider the full range of issues relevant here is to delve into the realms of religion, society, culture, psychology, and human personality. Neoclassical economic theory wants to say that humans can be conceptualized as calculating machines, taking decisions based on rational expectations in market dealings and using available information which will usually be sufficient for their purposes. The problem with this view is patently obvious once one begins to look at the ecological crisis. Huge numbers of people are ignorant and utterly unconcerned about the health of the ecological system, and that is a large part of the problem. Audio editor's note, Michael Dowd speaking. That is, in my opinion, rooted mostly in language. Simply by calling it the environment, you're tilting the playing field about how people think about it. Indigenous peoples and the environmental crisis. If we then ask which sections of society are concerned about the environment, the answer is largely people in the least developed societies, the indigenous populations, or the remnants of them, tribal societies and First Nations in Canada. As Noam Chomsky has pointed out, these are the societies trying to do something about the environmental crisis. And a quote from Chomsky, "In fact, all over the world, Australia, India, and South America, there are battles going on, sometimes wars. In India, it's a major war over direct environmental destruction, with tribal societies trying to resist resource extraction operations that are extremely harmful locally, but also in their general consequences. In societies where indigenous populations have an influence, many are taking a strong stand. The strongest of any country with regard to global warming is in Bolivia, which has an indigenous majority and constitutional requirements that protect, quote, the rights of nature, unquote." Why is this the case? To give an answer is to describe what disappeared, what was forgotten when economics developed. It is to describe the culture and belief systems that economics has claimed to replace. To think about people's relationship to the ecological system, as economists do, primarily as being about preferences, about how clean these people want the environment to be, will not help us resolve environmental problems. On the contrary, the mentality is a sure indicator of why we have an ecological crisis in the first place. It's a symptom of a dislocated and displaced culture. In a quite literal sense, it's the pathological worldview of a non-indigenous society whose members are not rooted in a place, who are almost entirely blind to nature and quite unaware of their own ignorance of it, as well as their dependence on it. Okay, that's great. So I'll say it again. Why is it that this is evolving, you know, that non-indigenous people can't think right about this? This mentality, that is, thinking of preferences and how clean these people want the environment to be, this mentality is a sure indicator of why we have an ecological crisis in the first place. It's a symptom of a dislodged and displaced culture. In a quite literal sense, it's the pathological worldview of a non-indigenous society whose members are not rooted in a place, who are almost entirely blind to nature and quite unaware of their own ignorance of it, as well as their dependence on it. In arguing that many indigenous peoples have by definition a closer relationship to and understanding of their sustaining ecological systems, I do not mean to imply that indigenous societies always got it right and never damaged their own ecosystems. Clearly, some indigenous peoples prior to European colonialism did make catastrophic ecological errors. Easter Island is a famous example where a community made disastrous mistakes in management of their ecological system. When settled in 800 AD, Easter Island was covered by tropical forests, and at its peak, the population rose to an estimated 10,000 people. However, the rate of forest clearance was greater than that of its regeneration, and the system passed a threshold, a tipping point, in which soil erosion was high and the forest could not regenerate. By 1600, their famous statues could no longer be built, and, significantly, canoes for catching large fish and marine mammals could no longer be constructed either. The population collapsed to an estimated 2,000 people. That's taken from Brian Walker and David Salt, Resilience Thinking. That's probably supposed to be Resilience Thinking. Nevertheless, it is clear that communities that inhabit a place for a long time and live off the surpluses of a fluctuating ecosystem, are likely over many generations to have a better understanding of what is sustainable and what is not. In most developed countries, quote-unquote, the very nature of development has led to society losing that ecological knowledge. To undo our cultural ignorance of these issues is a massive task. It involves questioning and rejecting foundational ideas in our culture and beliefs. It involves going back a long way in history and then rethinking what has happened. In fact, we must go back to so-called hunter-gatherer societies and try to understand them on their own terms rather than seeing them as, quote-unquote, primitive. In the last few decades, anthropological research has challenged the assumption that remaining hunter-gatherer societies, which had not embraced settled agriculture, were somehow backward. On the contrary, they were managed on a very sophisticated basis, and anthropologists like Marshall Sellens have gone so far as to claim that they were the original affluent societies. He argues that such cannot be understood by using economic principles which reflect Western values. Going further, Sellens proposes the radical idea that the agricultural Neolithic revolution cannot be said to have brought unquestioned progress. Stone Age economics. The existence of these original affluent societies challenged the foundational assumptions of economics. To quote Sellens, quote, "There are two possible courses to affluence, either by producing much or desiring little. The familiar conception makes assumptions particularly appropriate to market economies that man's wants are great, not to say infinite, whereas his means are limited, although improvable. But there is also a Zen way to affluence, departing from premises somewhat different from our own, that human material wants are finite and few, and technical means unchanging, but on the whole adequate." Unquote. If you live a nomadic existence, then possessions are a weight that hold you down. They are a burden. Imagine packing your possessions in a big suitcase and having to take them wherever you go. The hunter, one is tempted to say, is an uneconomic man, at least as concerns non-subsistence goods. He is the reverse of that standard caricature immortalized in any general principles of economics, page 1. His wants are scarce, and his means in relation are plentiful. Consequently, he is comparatively free of material pressures, has no sense of possessions, shows an undeveloped sense of property, is completely indifferent to material pressures, and manifests a lack of interest, quote-unquote, in developing his technological equipment. The principles of economics were not lived by hunter-gatherer societies, the so-called principles of economics. As a result, many of these societies were sustainable, in contrast to our own, which is very clearly not. This sustainability was rooted in a very deep understanding of the ecological system and respect for it. If we take as an example the way of life of the Australian Aboriginal people before white colonists arrived, it was one in which land care was the main purpose of life. Say it again. If we take as an example the way of life the Australian Aboriginal people before the white colonists arrived, it was one in which land care was the main purpose of life. Gamage quotes Bill Stanner. "No English words are good enough to give a sense of the links between an Aboriginal group and his homeland. The word home does not even match the Aboriginal word that may mean camp, hearth, country, everlasting home, totem place, life source, spirit center, and much, much else all in one. Our word land is too spare and meager." Aboriginal society was permeated by ecology, just as our society is chiefly characterized by its absence. I'll say it again. Aboriginal, indigenous society, sustainable society, was permeated by ecology, just as our society is chiefly characterized by its absence. In his book about Aboriginal land care in 1788, historian Bill Gammage explains how Aboriginal people in the Arnhem Land in Australia classified the countryside with a deep awareness of the ecological associations between animals and plants, what that meant for their food supply, the woods needed for spears and for resin and fibers at any season of the year. This relationship to quote-unquote land, in an expanded sense, for the indigenous person can be understood as belonging to a homeland. The concept of home is not fixed as an exact location, but covers an area of landscape. Gammage quotes Edwin Eyer, quote, "Another very great advantage on the part of the natives is in the intimate knowledge they have of every nook and corner of the country they inhabit. Does a shower of rain fall? They know very little. They know the very rock where a little water is most likely to be collected, the very hole where it is longest retained. Are there heavy dews at night? They know where the longest grass grows from which they may collect the spangles, and water is sometimes procured thus in great abundance." Unquote. Note again, the remark that English words are not good enough to express the relationship between Aboriginal people and homeland. There is a lexical void, a lack of words to express an idea, because the largely European cultures, both in Europe and in those continents to which the Europeans migrated, produced economics, quote-unquote, with missing cultural components. That is, all those features of thought which occur when a people belong to a place, but which are missing in the thought of a dislocated culture. Audio editor Michael Dowd again. That's a point that I make a lot these days, is that by calling primary reality, and that's what it is, it's primary reality, it's what we absolutely are dependent upon, by calling that any kind of a secular name that promotes a use-only-based relationship is unsustainable. The different relationship, people that belong to places versus places that belong to people. The crucial distinction here, and it cannot be found in economics textbooks, is between places belonging to people and corporations and people belonging to places. Indigenous people belong to places. Indigenous people belonging to places have lives bound into traditions connecting to deep knowledge of those places, their landscape and ecological features, the species that live there, and a sense of intergenerational responsibility for place and people. Say that again. Indigenous people belong to places, have lives bound into traditions connected to deep knowledge of those places, their landscape and ecological features, the species that live there, and a sense of intergenerational responsibility for place and people. Is a spiritual commitment and is what missing when the economic religion of the mercantile conquerors became the criteria by which the use of people and places were judged. I like that. That's missing. The intergenerational responsibility for people and place is a spiritual commitment that went missing when the economic religion of the mercantile conquerors became the criteria by which the use of people and places were judged. Wow. Indigenous people do not see the earth as a resource store that belongs to them. Instead, they often see themselves as part of the earth, as walking and living pieces of the earth. They do not have an anthropocentric worldview with humans as the peak of creation and its owner. Conversely, their worldview tends to be nature-centric, with humans merely participants and parts in this world. All right, I'm going to read that paragraph again. Indigenous people do not see the earth as a resource store that belongs to them. Instead, they often see themselves as a part of the earth, as walking and living pieces of the earth. They do not have an anthropocentric, that is, human-centered worldview, with humans as the peak of creation and its owner. Conversely, their view tends to be nature-centric, with humans merely participants and parts in this world. This is not Homo economicus-style thinking. It bears no comparison to preference utilitarianism. The difference in mentalities between people belonging to the land and the land belonging to people is much deeper. When people belong to the land, then the land has a spiritual dimension for them. They carry responsibilities in a way that private property owners do not. This different way of being includes the other living species as non-human persons. It involves deep practical knowledge and acts as a guide. Again, audio editor Michael Dowd speaking. That's why I'm trying to redeem the word God or God's nature We have to have a way of speaking about the living world upon which we depend, where that is acknowledged as a thou greater than us that we need to listen to and learn from and care for as our primary responsibility, a la Teddy Goldsmith in his book The Way, An Ecological Worldview. In contrast, economics describes a world in which private property owners take decisions about the use of use or management of their resources, which are inputs used to produce outputs. The language reflects a particular mentality that matches a way of doing things within a particular kind of society. Economics is not some kind of universal truth applicable for all time. It is a product of dislocation and displacement. It is a religion for non-indigenous peoples, people whose ancestors were displaced and dislocated, who now in the modern world move regularly, who have little attachment to place and a little sense of intergenerational responsibility for the descendants of a place. By contrast, for most of the history of humanity, communities of people lived with each other in a community of species, an ecosystem, in a landscape and or a waterscape. The diversity of the landscape and the diversity of the community needed to be maintained in balance, in harmony. In communities, driving the private interests of particular people at the expense of others in that community leads to tensions and conflict. Furthermore, to use the ecosystem in one way only is to undermine a variety of species and uses of the landscape. Tensions and conflict lie that way. The difference can be illustrated by the following quotes. I fought 9 years to obtain property titles for my community. Bureaucrats and ranchers showed me papers and more papers to demonstrate that our lands were privately owned. I did not care because in that land our grandparents are buried. They showed me papers. I showed them bones. When I received the title to our lands, the bureaucrats and the ranchers, who had laughed at me, asked, How did you obtain the land? With the bones of my ancestors, I replied. When Canadian government surveyors first ran across Giskan people in their traditional territory, the Giskan asked, What are you doing here? Surveying our land, answered the surveyors. Incredulous, the Giskan responded, If this is your land, where are your stories? That taken from Rasmussen, 2013. Deterritorialization in non-Indigenous societies. Economics, by contrast, is a product of a non-Indigenous culture, a non-sustainable culture. Belonging to places did not always mean belonging to an egalitarian society. In the European Middle Ages, belonging to a place came to involve a set of obligations to a feudal lord who imposed duties on serfs outside his castle walls. Many people had good reason to run away, and the medieval period ended partly because, in this process of moving and running away, multiple geographical and mental boundaries dissolved. A process of deterritorialization took place, in which people found a relative freedom from feudal extractions by living in towns, or by traveling to faraway places as the trade routes opened up. However, the process of change was one in which places came to belong to people instead of the other way around, particularly via the enclosure of the commons. Land grabbing took place by people who wanted to profit from the new mercantile connections, people who mostly lived in the towns and who were well connected politically. It took place over several centuries and completed and transformed European society, whose adventurers then went on to transform global society. Many of the people expelled from the land ended up as vagabonds and were either herded into the new factories or into punitive workhouses. They either migrated voluntarily or through transportation. A European diaspora began and took a colonial form. Now, several centuries after enclosure, people in towns and cities get their water through a tap and food from the supermarket. While the supermarkets jointly manage the countryside in many countries, working together with a global agribusiness corporations and financial markets. Meanwhile, many people in the cities change their location every few years in order to keep themselves in paid work. Economics is a theory developed by and for people who feel themselves as belonging nowhere in particular, although they may opportunistically pretend to belong in tax havens. Say it again. Economics is a theory developed by and for people who feel themselves as belonging nowhere in particular, although they may opportunistically pretend to belong in tax havens. Economists claim that in order to protect land, quote-unquote, or ecosystems, the living network of places, the living network of beings in a place and the community that lives there, it has to be owned as private property. The United Nations Environment Program tells us that in order to protect nature, we must give it a price and hardwire it into financial markets, quote-unquote, whose actors are global and who buy and sell assets often in minutes. The truth of the matter is the other way around. To protect a natural environment, a community must belong there, be rooted there, have understanding and know all the details of that place for generations, and intend to pass that place with all their knowledge down to their descendants. Say it again. To protect a natural environment, it's the opposite of what economists are claiming. Economists claim that in order to protect land or ecosystems, the living network of beings in a place and the community that lives there, it has to be owned as a private property. The United Nations Environment Program tells us that in order to protect nature, we must give it a price and hardwire it into financial markets, whose actors are global and who buy and sell assets often in minutes. The truth, this is the important paragraph, the truth of the matter is the other way around. To protect a natural environment, a community must belong there, be rooted there, have understood and know all the details of that place for generations, and intend, be committed to pass that place with all their knowledge down to their descendants. Most indigenous communities have a variation of the axiom that one must consider one's actions up to the seventh generation, that is, the generation after one's grandchildren's grandchildren. Say it again. Many indigenous communities have one variation or another on the axiom that one must consider one's actions up to the seventh generation, that is, the generation after one's grandchildren's grandchildren. That is what is meant to belong to a community that belongs to a place. Again, the seventh generation is what it means to belong to a community that belongs to a place. It is not an idea compatible with the economist's assumption that all people take long-term decisions using an interest rate with which they discount the future in favor of the present. Here's another quote from Rasmussen. I'm assuming that's Larry Rasmussen. Those who are embedded tend to look after a place. Those who are disembedded do not. A non-indigenous civilization is a complete rupture with the entire arc of human history. By the way, that doesn't mean all indigenous civilizations were saintly or nice. It just means that they were rooted. They may have uprooted others, enslaved people, created empires, but every human civilization, Inuit, Roman, Egyptian, Mayan, Haudusian, Anishinaabean, and so on, has had a homeland somewhere. Every civilization has had a particular place on earth that generation after generation felt beholden to, until now. We are now in a much better position to answer the question, how does it come about that it is indigenous and tribal peoples who are the ones who are fighting to save the environment? In theory, much scientific and ecological information is available to the people in quote-unquote developed societies, but these are societies made up of non-indigenous people. We non-indigenous people live a life where we take for granted and do not see it as at all peculiar. But we are displaced, and we belong nowhere. Aboriginal culture and land care in Australia lasted at least 8,000 years and possibly up to 50,000 years or longer. In that time, the possibilities for getting to know the ecological system were infinitely greater than anything that was possible after the agriculture developed to feed the towns where the intellectuals developed the knowledge system and theorized for the merchants in the emerging age of commerce. Differing epistemes, E-P-I-S-T-E-M-E-S, for different societies and traditional environmental knowledge. What we are describing here in the contrast between indigenous and non-indigenous worldviews is something that's a lot deeper than different paradigms of the world. What we are describing are different conditions of possibility for knowledge, different epistemes. Episteme is a term suggested by Foucault in his 1970 book, The Order of Things, to describe the different foundations for the way different societies think that creates the conditions of possibility for knowledge. An episteme is that which makes knowledge possible. In recent years, there has been a recognition by some economists and academics, who are mostly from dominant non-indigenous communities, of what is called traditional environmental knowledge, or TEK for short. There has been a dawning realization that indigenous cultures, which were previously bare, or which were previously barely given any attention by economists, actually possess valuable information relating to local ecosystems. An example of this occurred when economists and policymakers realized that it would be valuable to construct vulnerability indices for so-called less developed societies, like New Caledonia. This was in order to gain a better understanding of the reasons for the increased rate of natural disasters occurring in these societies. Such vulnerability indices are an innovation in economics because they admit the existence of natural limits on economic activity and represent a movement away from a concern for growth and development to a concern for resilience and sustainability. So, okay, I'm going to read this again. As an example occurred when economists and policymakers realized that it would be valuable to construct vulnerability indices for so-called less developed societies. This was in order to gain a better understanding of the reasons for increased rate of natural disasters occurring in those societies. Such vulnerability indices are an innovation in economics because they admit the existence of natural limits on economic activity and represent a movement away from a concern for growth and development to a concern for resilience and sustainability. Significantly, when this occurred, researchers suddenly discovered that indigenous people were a rich source of knowledge and information. Quote, "The context and importance of the practical activities of villagers has not been understood. Whole areas of knowledge had previously been unknown to the colonizing outsiders. Traditional medicines, control of pests and diseases, and the agricultural calendar where decisions about timing was one of the most important aspects of Melanesian life. The research survey concluded that while New Caledonians, the Kanak knowledge of nature and the environment was very large indeed, little of that rich heritage had been recorded. A convergence of concerns and purposes produced the discovery of knowledge by people whose experience had not been recognized or had been found interesting to researchers. This knowledge in turn led to researchers recognizing that, quote, they had to reform the standard terminology of GDP in order to accommodate their focus on risk, vulnerability, and the alternatives. It's important to make clear, however, that traditional environmental knowledge, TEK, is the way that non-Indigenous thinkers, like economists, conceptualize the knowledge of Indigenous people. Mm. For Indigenous people, the knowledge is not understood in the same way. It's framed very differently and arises from a different episteme, the spiritual significance of land and places. The term land, this is from McGregor, 2004. The term land is not restricted to the physical environment only. It has a much broader meaning, used by Indigenous people to refer to the physical, biological, and spiritual environments fused together. Editor's note, by spiritual, they're meaning a personal I-thou relationship, among other things. The closest scientific equivalent to the land, taken without its spiritual component, is ecosystem. Traditional knowledge is practical common sense, good reasoning, and logic based on experience. It's an authority system, a standard of conduct, setting out rules governing the use and respect of resources and an obligation to share. For example, it tells people that they do not have the right to hunt all animals of a species, as in wolf kill programs. The wisdom comes in using the knowledge and ensuring that it is used in a good way. It involves using the head and the heart together. Traditional knowledge is dynamic, yet stable, and is usually shared in stories, songs, dances, and myths. Traditional environmental knowledge comes, therefore, out of a different episteme. The economist lives in a world where, if he or she recognizes nature at all, this recognition consists of thinly understood species that are either crops or weeds, livestock or pests, and general wildlife. In other words, species already classified as to their market significance, as resources, or even as ecosystem services, assessed in relation to their use for humans. Information, quote-unquote, is framed in economics speak, which is absent of any sense of responsibility, any spiritual content, any loyalty, any feeling for other species. So I'm going to read that paragraph again. Traditional environmental knowledge comes, therefore, out of a totally different episteme. The economist lives in a world where, if he or she recognizes nature at all, this recognition consists of thinly understood species that are either crops or weeds, livestock or pests, and general wildlife. In other words, species already classified as to their market significance as resources, or even as ecosystem services, assessed in their relation to their use for humans. Information, quote-unquote, is framed in economic speak, which is absent of any sense of responsibility, any spiritual content, any loyalty, any feeling for other species. By contrast, a large proportion of the poorest people on the planet are struggling to keep it alive because they experience and know it to be as a being alive. Said again, by contrast, a large proportion of the poorest people on the planet are struggling to keep it alive because they experience and know it as being alive. They know and experience the ecosystem as communities of human and non-human beings, each of which is actively interpreting their environment, where this largely means interpreting each other and acting on their interpretations. This is really vital. I'm going to read this again. A large proportion of the poorest people on the planet are struggling to keep it alive because they experience and know it as being alive. They know and experience the ecosystem as communities of human and non-human beings, each of which is actively interpreting their environment, where this largely means interpreting each other and acting on their interpretations. In his writings about the Nuvalt and the Greenland Inuit, Peter Harris Jones compares the perspectives of scientifically trained ecologists and hunters. The Inuit regard animals as non-human persons, who are able to build up knowledge about their environment so that skilled hunters can rely not on their own interpretations of the environment, but that of the animals interpreting other animals in interaction with the environment. Quote, "The behavior of fish and seals not only gives signs about the location of fish and seals to Inuit hunters in Greenland, but indicates the behavior of whales, glaciers, winds, water temperatures, and other physical aspects of the environment. Greenland Inuit are able to observe and account for animal movements and other aspects of behavior in a systematic way because they believe that animals have their own semiotic interpretation of their environment." Unquote. This sense of nature as being animated, as being alive, of being a place of interbeing by selves or persons of different species, is not compatible with the neo-Darwinistic, neoliberal, bioeconomic vision of selfish genes or of biology as competing survival machines, which underpins much of non-Indigenous economic thinking. The Inuit view, however, is compatible with the emerging thinking in biology, which envisions the biological world as organisms which, as feeling, interpreting, and intentional selves, are involved in a process of self-creation, creation or autopoiesis. According to biologist Andreas Weber, quote, "Natural history should no longer be viewed as the unfolding of an organic machine, but rather as the natural history of freedom, autonomy, and agency. Reality is alive. It is full of subjective experience and feeling. Subjective experience and feeling are the prerequisites of any rationality. The biosphere consists of a material and meaningful interrelationship of selves." Wow, I'm going to read that again. Natural history should, this is a quote from Andreas Weber, W-E-B-E-R, not sure how it's pronounced. "Natural history should no longer be viewed as the unfolding of an organic machine, but rather as the natural history of freedom, autonomy, and agency. Reality is alive. It is full of subjective experience and feeling. Subjective experience and feeling are the prerequisites of any rationality. The biosphere consists of a material and meaningful interrelation of selves." If the biosphere and the economy, too, are made up of an interrelation of selves that have a degree of autonomy, freedom, and agency, it makes sense to grasp and understand this kind of world through stories. There is, to be sure, a place to understand things through science based on measurement and mathematics, but stories and narrative give a different kind of understanding, which is why telling the story of economics, the people who thought it up, and the conditions in which they did so, gives us a different perspective about it from reading a textbook written as if economics was a finished product. Well, that's very insightful. There are some mysteries we cannot ever understand. The Tao, T-A-O, that can be told is not the eternal Tao. The Great Spirit is the great mystery. Deborah McGregor quotes Elder Annie Catholic, quote, "When the government people talk about land, I find it very funny. Talking about all the things we use, all the things we survive on, like animals and caribou and those things. When I think about the land, I think about the Great Spirit." It should be remembered that stories as explanations and as guides for living are often the creation of peoples whose culture are non-literate. And there's a danger for literate people to assume that non-literate must be ignorant, as it is assumed that knowledge must be stored somewhere external, on paper or in digital form, to count and to be taken into account. However, an oral tradition has its own features and possibilities of knowing and of passing on knowledge. It has other ways of people remembering together, while at the same time bestowing significance to what is important, anchored into the rhythms of life. Say it again. It should be remembered that stories as explanations and as guides for living are often the creation of peoples whose cultures are non-literate. And there's a danger for literate people to assume that the non-literate must be ignorant, as it is assumed that knowledge must be stored somewhere external on paper or digital form, to count and to be taken into account. However, an oral tradition has its own features and possibilities of knowing and passing on knowledge. It has other ways of people remembering together, while at the same time bestowing significance to what's important, anchored into the rhythms of life. Rituals, ceremonies, and totems. A practice repeated, perhaps on a seasonal basis by a community, becomes a ritual. Other ways in which people can synchronize their feelings and thoughts are through ceremonies. These help ideas and practices to be remembered. Say it again. A practice repeated, perhaps on a seasonal basis by a community, becomes a ritual. Other ways in which people can synchronize their feelings and thoughts are through ceremonies. These help ideas and practices to be remembered. The point about such rituals and ceremonies is that they create continuity and stability. They fix things. In this context, it is understandable that a community can come to believe that the failure to perform a ritual or the failure to perform it correctly will throw the world into chaos. It will be a formless and void again. To the Australian Aborigines, it was when the creator ancestors did these things for the first time that the world was created out of the void. To remember how to cross a landscape safely without maps and service stations, a community evolves song lines. I express this in non-Indigenous thought. To the Aboriginal people, the landscape was created by the creator ancestors who sang the landscape into existence. These song lines were based on the landscape and the creatures in that landscape with their ecological associations. Thus, for example, sites along a red kangaroo song line match the best habitat for the red kangaroo, a description of the landscape from the red kangaroo perspective, including a hunting ban at the major sites. Thus, the creator ancestors had decreed a conservation imperative when they sang the landscape into existence, which meant that kangaroos had refuges. In bad seasons, they had to have somewhere to breed and recover. Only when their numbers built up again and they moved off the refuges could they be hunted. Proximity to animals and species that once has a need to understand creates more... Hold on. Proximity to animals and species that one has a need to create to understand creates more than a conceptual involvement. It engages emotions. It creates identification and involvement, which are inconceivable to people who connect to animals as packaged meats or as plants trimmed, cooked, tinned, and on a shelf. Totems are thus more than badges and labels. They are allegiances. Say it again. Totems are more than badges and labels. They are allegiances. Once again, we must grasp the right direction meant when the word belonging is used. Gamage comments that in English, a totem can simply be a badge. However, for Aboriginal people, a totem is a life force stemming from and part of a creator ancestor. Thus, an emu man is the same soul and flesh as an emu and must look after it and its habitat, just as it must care for him. It is not his totem, he is of its totem. Quote, "This is nature and its species as kin. With this mindset and with spiritual relationship to land, it was a requirement of all people to care for the land and its creatures, regenerating the land through ceremonies, protecting totem species and their habitats. This in turn made land care purposeful, universal, and predictable, even in what seemed to European settlers to be an untouched wilderness. This is nothing like the environmental preferences of a utilitarian sense, symbolized with a badge. With different members of the community having different totems, and those community members knowing everything about their totem species in great detail, the community has biodiversity protection built into the belief system and into the social structure. Say it again, this is nothing like an environmental preference in a utilitarian sense, symbolized with a badge. With different members of the community having different totems, and those community members knowing everything about their totem species in great detail, the community has biodiversity protection built into the system, the belief system, and into the social structure. End of chapter.